Hey guys, it's Albert. We're going to kick things off by giving you my winners in 2019 free agency. Then Jenny and Connor come in to break down all the news, including stuff on Odell Beckham and Le'Veon Bell and Kyler Murray. And then as always, we wrap things up with a six-pack of your Twitter questions. Let's go. All right, welcome back in. Free agency isn't over, but it is kind of over. It's the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer. We're going to recap everything that happened over the course of the last week or so. It's been 8 days, 9 days now since the legal tampering period came to an end. And so what I want to do is I want to open things up because everybody does grades this time of year and everything else. I want to open up by giving you my free agency winners, okay? So my free agency winners right now, I like what the Cowboys did. I like what the Patriots did. I like what the Rams did, what the Dolphins did, what the Chargers did, what the Seahawks did. Because those teams really didn't do much of anything. I think this is a bad place to spend money. And I think the teams that showed restraint are going to be rewarded for it. Now, I think what's so interesting is if you look at this year's the action on this year's market, and you look at the spending, five of the six teams that were the lowest spenders over the first week of free agency actually made the playoffs last year. Now, there's reasons for that, of course, because those teams have their own guys to take care of and everything else. The sixth team is the Dolphins, who are in a full rebuild, and we'll get to them in a little bit. But this is a bad place to spend money, and I think history's proven that. You do have your aberrations. The Broncos in 2013 bringing in Aqib Talib and – or in 2014, bringing in Aqib Talib, DeMarcus Ware, T.J. Ward, Emmanuel Sanders. So we've seen it work in the past. The Rams have been more aggressive the last couple of years. The Eagles have been more aggressive. But part of that's been through making trades. And so I think normally what you see is in this environment, teams get desperate, teams overspend, teams set themselves up for failure. And before I bring Jenny and Connor in, I'm going to give you four reasons why. Reason number one, you have cap space because you suck. Teams that have all that cap space are in that position because they don't have guys in their own roster to pay. And if you want to go back and you want to look at the Colts and the Jets 5 years ago, these teams with all this cap space, what do you see? You see a string of bad drafts, right? In fact, if you look at the Jets in 13, 14, and 15, they have one player each from each of those draft classes left. There is no one to pay. Same goes for the Colts. So that's number one. You have cap space because you're not very good. Number two, players are available for a reason. And that doesn't mean all players are available for a reason. Sometimes the teams are trying to bring back those players. But in most cases, you'll see that the team let the player go because he was not a member of their core. He was probably a second-tier player. And so in a lot of cases, you're asking a second-tier player to come in and based on his salary be a part of your core. So that's another reason why that doesn't work. Number three, you're always buying high on these guys. And I think history tells us that the most effective way to acquire players is to buy low on them. And so when you're buying a guy when his value is the highest, chances are you're not going to get a great return. And number four, and I thought this was really interesting, and I'll bring in Connor and Jenny now, was really interesting was talking to a couple teams about how they track some of this stuff, right? And what a couple of these teams told me was you almost never get the same or better production from a player than he had in his contract year. One of the teams I talked to said their number was based on their grades. So obviously this is all sort of, you know, subjective. But based on their grades, only 30% of players going somewhere else in unrestricted free agency wind up having as good a year in their first year with a new team as they had in their last year with the old team. Another team I talked to had that number closer to 40%, but the point is that you don't get the same production. Now, there are a number of reasons why. There's human nature, of course. Sometimes guys get paid, they kick their feet up a little bit. The other part of it, football is such a scheme-specific game that can really affect how guys fit. But I don't know, man. Like, we always go crazy this time of year, and I know we talked about it last week too, but we always go crazy this time of year. And more often than not, when I looked at this over the course of the weekend, like more often than not, this is the case where the good teams are on the sidelines. But I thought it was even more pronounced this year, where you see so many teams that have been at the top of the league that are established, like multi-year playoff teams, are just saying the hell with it. We're not going to take part in this.
So, trivia question for you. When I wrote about this last week, I listed the three teams who spent the most in free agency every year for the last 7 years. How many? So that's 21 teams. How many of those teams made the playoffs?
Zero.
What do you think?
Is this a did I read Connor check?
Two.
Six. So 6 out of 21. But again, like, one of those teams was the Denver Broncos, and they were the highest right. spending team in free agency because I got Peyton Manning.
The
so
Giants.
I think there's the Giants 1 year, yeah. You know, the Bears, but the Bears had a lot of their own guys to re-sign, so that's another.
Yeah.
But to your point, yeah, I mean, about a third of these teams are moderately successful, but a lot of those teams then after that have not made the playoffs since, which
right.
is sort of a, you know, it's certainly a landmine for your salary cap.
And in a lot of cases, too, is teams just kind of it like, we do have GMs who survived this year, which that was something else that you mentioned it last week. And it was brought up with some of the discussions I had over the last few days of some of these teams. Like, you have GMs who are trying to save their jobs. And I actually brought your question up to them. Like, how is it that, like, these owners are letting this happen?
Who's managing the managers?
Right. Like, how is this, like how if you're an owner and you know your general manager's on shaky ground, how would you let him go out and spend all your money and say, like, oh, well, the hell with it. Like, I may be out of here next year anyway, so this is somebody else's problem if it doesn't work. Like, that's the part that, and I like a lot of these teams, like, a lot of people with teams I asked about that were baffled by it, too. It's like, why is there not more control over that? Like, why isn't there more?
You can call it the Orr paradox.
Yeah. Connor Orr has his pulse on the discussions around the league, how owners should be feeling. He knows how they should be feeling even before they actually feel it.
That's right. That's my connection with the rich, the 1%. You know, I've always felt that, you know.
There you go. Okay, so this is not a good place to spend money. We went wild on it over the course of the last week, but bad idea to spend your money here. We'll jump right into the news now. There's a lot we haven't gotten to, and I do want to cover some of the stuff that's actually a few days old now, just because we didn't have a chance to cover it last week. And I think the podcast dropped on Wednesday morning, so it was right after a couple of big things happened. Odell, we'll get to Le'Veon in a second. We'll start right there with Odell Beckham. News topic number one, the Giants traded Odell Beckham to the Browns last week in a deal that brought Kevin Zeitler, Jabril Peppers, and first and third round picks to New York, with Olivier Vernon going back to Cleveland with Beckham. Just open it up. What do you guys think?
I did not hate this trade. It got a lot of criticism,
yeah.
But I do not hate it for the Giants. I think that it seemed like it was inevitable. You can criticize, of course, signing him to the contract last year and then trading him a year later and wonder what the plan is. I understand that. I think that part of the reason they signed him to the extension last year was because they didn't want the, you know, a talented big name player on a contract year with the first year head coach. So they just made the move. Mm-hmm. And you can sort of understand that. And they felt like if a deal came up that they thought was good enough, they would make the move. Now, a lot of people don't think the return was good enough, but you know, I think that Peppers is a player that makes a lot of sense for the Giants since they lost Collins. And I think that, you know, over time it was probably going to be an untenable relationship between Odell and the Giants. That was what we have seen to date. It hadn't shown any sign of changing. And so they felt like now was time to make the move.
I like that we said Odell did. He said he's going dark to reevaluate things, and everyone, you know, there was a lot of like sadness around this trade.
Is he going to come out of this darkness with a blonde mustache?
I don't know, but like, there seemed to be a lot of sadness about this. But it's like, why are we feeling bad for a guy that gets to go play with his best friend?
Yeah.
Like, this is probably an amazing situation for him. And you know, I know that he had to kind of act somber in his goodbye to New York, I guess, to keep whatever relationship he wants to keep there intact. But like, my God, how much more fun is that going to be for him than it is in New York? Like, explosive young quarterback, great running game, excellent, you know, everything across the board. You're the most talented team in football this year.
I also think with like with pro athletes in general, I think where you live has become so like I think the idea of a guy having to play in a certain city has become so overrated, because during the season, it's not like, I mean, like, it's not like they've got this abundance of time to do whatever
Odell
they
lives
want
in L.A.
Right.
He lives
like,
in L.A.
Like, Odell is playing in New York, like, right? Like, playing in the number one.
I think
one.
He spends a lot of time in L.A. even during the
right,
season.
Right,
so.
And that's the thing is, like, so, like, he's actually closer to L.A. now, actually. I don't think that there's, like, I think that part of it's overrated. Like, you're only living in the city that you play in for a certain amount of time. It's way less than it used to be. It's, what, 10 weeks in the spring and then the season. And it's not like you've got this abundance of time. You've got the means to go wherever you want. And, like, to be in Cleveland, if you win, Cleveland's like, this is part of what I think, and we talked about this, I think, Jenny, this is part of what what like Le'Veon Bell gives up in Pittsburgh. Cleveland's one of those places where if you win big there, like you're going to be able to make money in that city for the rest of your life. Like that's it's just one of those places. And so I think all of that is there for Odell. I think this is a really good situation for him. Offensive-minded head coach, like you said, like a really good young quarterback, gets to play with his best friend. Like a lot of positivity in that place. It seems like it'll be an accepting place to who he wants to be, like all the stuff that he brings with him. Like, so I think all that's there for him. And I don't hate it for the Giants. You know why? Because you're going to be bad the next 2 or 3 years anyway. Like, so what sense does that mean? Like, what sense is there, like, having a guy, like, with that value in his prime on your roster when you're going to be bad? Like, they can't come out and say it. Like, Pat Shurmur and Dave Gettleman can't come out and say it. But they know it. They're not going to be very good for the next couple of years. That roster they inherited was broken. This is going to take time. Maris said that. Like, if you're the Giants, like seriously, like, what sense does it make to have Odell Beckham in his prime on your roster when you're going to be when you're going to be out of the playoffs, I think, for at least the next couple of years?
Yeah, I mean, that roster turnover has been really remarkable. I think I looked it up. What was it? There's only three starters from opening day in 2016 that are still left on the roster. So they're clearly, they've done a churn. They don't like, I mean, everyone hates calling it a rebuild, but they have certainly done a total roster turnover. And yeah, I mean, I think you're looking at a long process here.
I think what's going to be kind of amazing to a lot of people, and you know, I wrote this over the weekend, was that how we won't see from Odell Beckham any surprise around his antics when he's placed in this different context, where, like, you know, Baker Mayfield does Fortnite dances and, you know, all these guys are exciting and stuff like that. And, you know, we might get halfway through the season and nobody even notices what Odell Beckham is doing on the field anymore because everybody else is like that on that team.
Okay, so here's the other thing. I think Gettleman's being beat up a little unnecessarily. And here's the reason why. Like, I think he's got the track record where you should at least have some patience with him. And he's been there for a year, right? Like, I think he's at least got the track record. And look, he was part of building two Super Bowl teams with the team that he's with now, right, with the Giants. He goes to Carolina. He inherits a nightmare of a cap situation. And they're in the Super Bowl, like, 3 years later. Like, and I'm not saying like he's wholly responsible for everything in Carolina. Having Cam helped, and he didn't draft Cam, right? So like, it's not all about him there. But the guy's got a pretty good track record, and you needed to rebuild the thing. And I just like there's part of me that looks at this and says, like, do we all really know better than Gettleman? I mean, he brought in a much cheaper version of Landon Collins, right? And I think Collins got way overpaid on the market. If you're going to be bad, does it make sense to have Landon Collins on your roster on a one-year deal, or does it make sense to flip him for the third-round comp that you're going to get next year? It's just, like, I think most of the moves you see them making are, like, you can see, like, there's a long-term idea in mind. Well, most of them, the Golden Tate one's the one that flies in the face of that. But other than that, like, it looks like everything's sort of set up where over the next year or two, you put a young quarterback in there and you start building around him.
Yeah, I felt legitimately bad for him. What is today? Tuesday?
Yeah.
On Monday when he had to do his media tour, and you know, by the time he was on, you know, local radio here, he just was like, I'm tired of answering questions, like stupid questions. You know what I mean? And like accusatory questions, you know. And you know, I think that I beat up on him initially, like a lot of people did, because it was hard to understand. And I think that what's still hard to understand is sort of this unwillingness to sort of meet your star receiver halfway. But that's dating back to before him, you know.
Yeah.
And that's before Gettleman. I think that's just an organizational thing. But
I mean, I just don't think, like, I hate to, like, I sound like a broken record, but, like, it's like, and I understand what you're saying about meeting him halfway. I just don't see the sense on, like really stretching to make this work when you're going to be bad anyway.
Yeah, you know, I agree with you, Connor. Like, I think where Gettleman got himself in trouble was probably at the combine. Like, I think it's some of the word choice that he uses, right? Because he's not this, like,
he's combative,
suave, polished guy. He's combative. Well, yes, not the accent necessarily, but you know, just saying, like, wow, we didn't sign him to trade him, okay, and, like, sort of dismissing the question. But from his perspective, it's, you know, you know, he's just thinking, I don't want the world to think that, you know, I want to get as good an offer. So that's how he's thinking. I think where the gap then is like you have a fan base that wants some answers. And so even though it's not his responsibility to tell the media, you do want to give some indication to the, you know, your fans, paying fans that you're on the right track. But then again, you don't want to give your plans away, which I totally understand. So I think a lot of it comes from the combative demeanor. Yeah, I think that's part of it.
And I think part of it too is like, it's not just being combative. It's like, and I can sort of understand this because I know a lot of people, like he's from where I'm from. And like, so he's like a lot of people in that region are like this. Like he sort of comes into conference calls and press conferences. I've noticed this, like it's really, I feel like I've known it before, but like I've really noticed it the last couple of times. Like he comes into press conferences and conference call, like it's almost like he's pissed off coming in. You know what I mean? Like right. It's almost like he's already fighting the questions that he expects to be getting. You know, like you hear him come on and it's like, all right, I know what you're going to freaking ask. So here's what's happening. And you're all a bunch of idiots for thinking that this is the case when this is really the case. Like that's where it is. And I probably have a better shot of pulling off the accent than you guys do. But there is like, there's definitely like a, like you said, I think accusatory. Like he's like when he's gotten into these situations, he's like immediately accusing people of these narratives that he's expecting to be questioned
because
on.
He does listen and read though. Like, I mean, you know, I was at, I think his opening press conference or one of the ones really early in his tenure. And he's mentioning things that beat writers said on radio hits on Sirius XM. I mean, there's some obscure kind of stuff that he's referencing here.
Rabbit
I mean,
ears.
You know, but good for, you know, I think it's eventually going to be fine, especially when, I'm just going to drop this and we're going to move on, especially when they sign Russell Wilson. And
Ooh. All right.
Because him and Sierra want to live in New York.
All right. Was Jimmy Fallon brought that up
That's
again?
Right,
Jimmy. Yeah. That was a Jimmy Fallon.
Intrigue.
Rumor.
News item number two.
Yep.
After nearly 2 days on the market, the Jets agreed to terms with Le'Veon Bell, completing a free agent class that included C.J. Mosley and Jamison Crowder and almost Anthony Barr. Bell inked a 4-year, $52 million deal.
I'm sorry for the bland language on that.
Yeah. So going back to what I looked at, this is now the fourth time since 2015 that the Jets have been one of the three highest spending teams in free agency.
It's what? Say again?
It's either the third or the fourth time since 2015 that the Jets have been one of the three highest spending teams in free agency. So definitely a put up or shut up moment for Mike Maccagnan here.
So the approach that brought you Tremaine Johnson is back again.
Yeah. You know, I think certainly to kind of tie it back to the beginning of the podcast, I think he's certainly a guy who's feeling it a little bit. And what's interesting about this is you can couch it as, well, I'm just trying to do what's best for Sam Darnold, and I'm just trying to get Greg Williams the pieces that he needs to run this defense. But at the same time, I mean, you know, I don't know who else would have given Le'Veon Bell that money. You know, I don't know who would have come that close to CJ, you know, what CJ Mosley's making pass rusher money,
right.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, Mosley's making, like, the Ravens' final offer was 14, so they went way beyond what the original team was willing to pay him. Like you said, Le'Veon Bell, no one was really that close. Jenny, you have some information on that, but, like, nobody was really that close to where the Jets went on Bell. To me, so much of this is just going to hang on, because this is, like, if they did a better job drafting, you would look at this and say, well, this is a smart way to take advantage of having your young quarterback, right? So I think so much of what happens here is going to depend on what becomes of Jamal Adams, what becomes of Marcus May, what becomes of Ardarius Stewart, who's a young receiver who hasn't really panned out there, what becomes of Sam Darnold, obviously, what becomes of Chris Herndon, like, and what becomes of the 2019 draft class? Like, what becomes of those players, I think, is going to really dictate how this looks. Because most of these contracts, to me, like most of these contracts, you're going to be able to get out of them after a couple of years. And these guys are good players. These guys that are bringing in are good players. So if everything's right around them and you've got good young players around them, then it could look like the Rams looked, right? But if you strike out on a bunch of those draft picks, then you don't have a chance.
Yeah, so we spent a little time with Le'Veon Bell this weekend, and his decision came down to the Jets and the 49ers. And the Jets' offer was a lot better than the 49ers offer. The 49ers offer, he said, was 3 years for $40 million. And there were a lot of injury guarantees, but not a lot of full guarantees, right, Albert? We ferreted that out a little bit, that the full guarantee there was much smaller than the $25 million full guarantee. So the Jets basically gave Bell, you know, he wanted something that was some kind of mark. And so they basically gave him that fully guaranteed mark for running backs that was slightly above David Johnson. And, you know, but the market did not quite materialize the way that I think he had hoped. But, you know, one thing he said that hearing him talk, which I do think is really true, is that he put out that $15 million number for running backs. And he's like, you know, he feels like, you know, he has a chance to get that in New York, even though the incentives are very hard to earn. But, you know, Gurley got that, right? And so he felt like he kind of put that number out there and had a role in resetting the market. And I think he definitely did. So he said, you know what, it might not have worked out for me, but I kind of changed the running back compensation because the market had really sagged for backs for a while.
Yep.
It was really low, right? Devontae Freeman signed for $8.25 million a year in 2017. Think about that, right? And then all of a sudden we reset it with Gurley, and Bell did play a role in resetting Gurley because you have a guy who's on a $14.5 million franchise tag. So that helps the numbers jump up. So, you know, I thought that was an interesting perspective. And, you know, again, he's happy. He's the only one who's not second guessing.
I was
going to
say, do you think he's like at peace with?
He's at peace because the thing that came out, I think, in our conversation, which he hadn't really explicitly said, was it wasn't just the money in Pittsburgh. Now, he said that he was, you know, getting to a point where he kind of wanted to move on, and I think as the season wore on, he felt like he couldn't go back there anyway.
Which is, I do want to talk about that too because we don't have this in our topics, but I think the Pittsburgh. I think it's fascinating where Pittsburgh goes from here. And I know everybody wants to assign blame, right? Like it's Ben's fault, it's AB's fault, it's Le'Veon's fault. Is it possible they're just all a-holes?
Only one of the three people you mentioned is currently blocking me on Twitter, so I'm going to sit out this conversation because I have an opinion. So, but I'm biased.
But you think
I'm biased on the
matter. Think it's Ben?
I think
here's my take on it is all three are right. My take on it is all three handle this poorly. Ben, because he's the quarterback, has more responsibility. Like that's my feeling. It's like you're the quarterback, you're paid more, you are basically quasi management when you're the quarterback. You are you carry a heavier burden of responsibility than everyone else in the building. So I think it's more on Ben than everybody else, but I think everybody shoulders some blame for that not working out and for them not being able to hold that together.
So we talked about this with Bell, who was great with us. He spent 2.5 hours, and when it came to Ben specifically, he was very careful how he picked his words. He's like, I don't want to go out there and say he's a bad guy, but he did say that Ben was a reason why he wanted to move on from Pittsburgh. It wasn't the only reason, but it was a factor. And I think he felt like his relationship with him wasn't like equal teammates. He felt like, in his view, in the organization, Ben sees himself on a level with Kevin Colbert. And look, quarterbacks do have different roles in different organizations, but I think it is in contrast to things you hear out of New England where Brady is introducing himself to the rookies and things like that. So Bell felt like it wasn't an equal level, you know, conversation. He felt when they were, you know, he felt like it wasn't open and genuine, I think were the words he used.
I think what you said too, like that's so interesting because we have seen so many examples of other quarterbacks like almost going out of their way to be like, they know they're not like everybody else, but like, I'm going to do little things to try to make it look like I'm everybody. Like Brady forever had his press availability at his locker, which was a pain in the ass for everyone, right? But he did it because it was like, I'm not different than you. I'm not going to the podium. Now, that eventually changed, but we've seen that with Rodgers too. Aaron Rodgers does his availability in front of the locker. Like, there are, I feel like most quarterbacks do all of these little things to try to make themselves like one of the guys, you know? And like what Jenny just said, as far as what Le'Veon's done, like what Le'Veon said, like that runs counter to, I think, the way a lot of quarterbacks try to handle their business.
Do you feel like Le'Veon felt that was a personal thing, or do you think that was sort of something that was kind of trickled down to everybody, like not only him?
It was not a personal thing. He felt like it was Ben and Kevin Colbert on one level and the other players on the other. He did.
Colbert didn't help with his comments.
Yes, we did bring that up. And again, I do think Bell was trying to pick his comments wisely. So here's one, so not to misquote, but in the story, here's one quote that he said about that I thought gave a picture of what's going on there. He said the organization wants to win, Tomlin wants to win, Ben wants to win, but Ben wants to win his way, and that's tough to play with. Ben won a Super Bowl, but that's when he won when he was younger. Now he's at the stage where he tries to control everything, and the team let him get there. So I think that that is a pretty, I think that's an accurate portrayal. And you know, it didn't come from like a bitter place. Like he wasn't sitting here
so
being
like matter of fact.
It was just really matter of fact, you know? And I think, you know, he did talk about his usage, which I said to him, well, you had 400 touches. Like it did seem like you got the ball a lot, but he said he felt like Ben's personal preferences played a role in who would get the ball in which games, which of course the quarterback plays a role in where the ball is distributed. And, you know, you always hear stories of quarterbacks who don't go to certain guys if someone drops it. But I think this was a little bit different. I think he was trying to say like personal feelings had a role mm-hmm. in where the ball was going, and that was frustrating.
Okay, so do you guys like the Jets picking up Bell then? Forget Mosley, forget Crowder. Do you guys think that that was the right thing to do?
I'm excited to read the story. I think it's going to change my mind. I think I'm gonna give the move a thumbs up after reading it.
By the way, so. The story's going to be online on...
Yeah, we got to give this a pop.
Wednesday. It'll be Wednesday morning.
Okay, Wednesday morning,
so by the time
online.
The pod goes up, it should be up
and
already.
And it'll be in the magazine, so you guys can look out for that. So you're changing your mind? You didn't like the Bell move, and now you do?
You know what? This is funny. Like, not only just what happened now, but like I was just talking to a few friends about it, and everyone's like, "No, you're an idiot. This is great." And so I'm like, you know, am I missing something? And so I went back, and you know, I think this is me coming full circle. Great job, Jets.
I do think we forget how dynamic of a
yes.
player he was.
Yeah.
And I think the other factor here is that you say, okay, well, they, you know, Tevin Coleman can do similar things and, you know, could have gotten for less money. But listen, the Jets had cap space to spend.
Right.
And I don't know. I think he's motivated.
I look at it as like, okay, like I just think so much of this is going to depend on so much around him, because the line has been, like, let's call it what it is. The line's been a tire fire the last couple of years. I don't know. Is there a single player on that line that would like start on like the Rams or the Patriots or the Saints or the
Brian Winters, right?
Brian Winters probably
would start.
Yeah.
I feel like anyone could start
okay.
on the Patriots line.
Yeah, I mean Dante would probably turn
probably
like Brian Shell into yeah, probably turn him into like John Hanna. The point is, like, I think a lot has to be right around Bell. And it's almost, to me, to make it a success, it's like, I think you're bringing him in to help your young quarterback, to take some of the burden off your young quarterback, to give him an outlet, to kind of create a better environment around him the way that the Rams have been able to do with Gurley. And so, like, that part of it, if he can do that for you, and if at the end of year three we're talking about Sam Darnold, like, this is a future NFL MVP, this is a guy that you're going to be able to build around for 10 or 15 years, there's no price too high to pay for that. If Bell's a big part of that, then I think it was worth it. Then I think you got it right. And there's potential for that to happen because, again, the model's there. I mean, it's Gurley and Goff, right? Like, mm-hmm. that's the way I look at it.
Totally, yeah. And I think he was really excited to play with Darnold. Like, you know, obviously the Jets were offering the best offer, and that was, you know, contract, you know, money talks and negotiations. But I think he was legitimately excited to play with Darnold, a younger quarterback, and, like, feel like he's got a role in developing the guy. Like, I think it's just a different relationship than it would be in Pittsburgh with Ben.
And the interesting thing, and we're going to jump to the next topic after this, but the interesting thing is that they've invested in three positions in free agency that generally aren't high dollar positions, right? Like, so an off-ball linebacker, right, in CJ Mosley, a slot receiver in Jamison Crowder, and a running back. So that's like really where you haven't seen teams like some teams out, like the Patriots have allocated resources at those positions, but a lot of teams haven't. Those haven't been high money positions, and so it's interesting that they've kind of pushed the market up at those spots. Anyway, all right. News item number three, Connor? Who read the last one? You read the last one, right, Jenny?
I'll read this one.
Okay.
Kyler Murray completed the next leg of the draft process on Wednesday, showing off his arm strength in a controlled setting at his pro day in Norman, Oklahoma. What's left for Murray will all be private with teams, workouts on the Oklahoma campus, and visits to NFL facilities. So you and I both wrote about it a little bit, Albert, but
yeah.
The feedback I got was that, you know, throwing session was great as
yep.
advertised. I mean, obviously, if you don't look good throwing on air, then you have no chance
right.
to be an NFL quarterback.
And that's why, like, the Teddy Bridgewater one was like such a big deal
right.
a few years ago.
It's
right.
It's rare when it goes badly. But I think, you know, they really made a focus on, you know, in the pocket throws, and he looked really good from what I had heard, you know, throwing to all different levels of the field, left and right, all kinds of different routes from inside the pocket, which he is a great pocket passer. Yeah. Like if you talk to teams, they're like, his dad trained him really well to be a very good pocket passer. I mean, he's got the movement stuff, but that's just a handful of times a game or when he needs to. So, you know, I don't think it changed anything. You know,
here's where I'm at with him. I think, like, we're now at the point where, and I think teams are playing catch up with him, right? Like, so there were, like, in September and October, all these teams were like, well, you know, we don't. In September and October, all these teams were being told, like, don't even bother, right? Like, he's playing baseball, don't even bother. Then November, the questions, the rumors, all that stuff starts to circulate. And then, you know, I think in January, teams are starting to try to gather information because they don't, like, know enough. They don't know as much about him as they would a typical quarterback prospect because they weren't looking at him because they thought he was going to play baseball. I think we're now, like, very quickly, I think we've gotten to the point now where either you like him or you don't. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like if you're comfortable with a 5'10", 195, 200-pound quarterback, like, then you probably love him. And if you, and if you, if you'd rather have something more traditional, you're not going to like. I don't think there's anybody changing their mind now. You know, like, he checked the box as far as throwing it. We know how athletic he is. Like, I think we're at the point, if you're open-minded to going to being a little different and drafting a guy of that size, higher than a player at that position at that size has ever been drafted before, then you're probably really good with him now. He's checked all the boxes, and if you aren't comfortable with it, you're never going to be comfortable with it.
Which is why I applaud him. I think that a lot of these guys are starting to get smart, you know, about the way that they're handling this process. And I know that, you know, there's some differing opinions in terms of, oh, well, you know, he didn't run or he didn't do this, and, you know, he's not a gamer, he doesn't want to compete. You're putting the onus back on the scouts. You know, this is all that you guys have said, scouts and general managers, since the beginning of time, is that we trust the tape, we trust our eyes, we watch the tape. So Kyler Murray is challenging him on that. So is Rashawn Gary, maybe. You know, a couple of these guys that aren't doing the typical dog and pony show here and saying, okay, you've seen me on film, you know what I can do, so draft me based on those merits and those merits alone. Don't make me go, you know, run, hop, skip, and jump just because, you know, it's fun for everybody else.
I still wanted to see him run a 40. I just want to see how fast he is. I mean, just from a, just from the spectacle of it, I still wanted to see him run a 40.
But, like, watch the Alabama game last year. You know, like, watch him play Army. Like, he's fast. You know?
I just want, like, because I've heard fast. So I had a discussion with Lincoln Riley a few weeks ago, and he said to me, like, Kyler ran low 4.3s when he was in the worst shape I've ever seen him. Like, they've gotten him in the 40 once while he was at Oklahoma. It was right after he transferred from Texas A&M. And Lincoln told me this is the worst shape I've seen him in. And he ran low 4.3s. So once I heard that, I'm like, God, I just want to know how fast he actually is, you know? And that's selfish. Like, maybe it wouldn't help him, but, like, it's just selfishly.
Totally wouldn't help him.
selfishly, I just want to see how fast he is.
It is funny how the conspiracy theories on size, like, continue to mushroom, right? Yeah. So he didn't get measured for height, which I asked around a little bit, and I guess none of the guys from Oklahoma who'd been to the combine remeasured for height. But then you have, you know, the weight situation, and then he doesn't run the 40, and then everyone's like, is it because he, you know, would be slower at this weight. So, I mean, it is amusing that, like, the size, you know, conspiracy. I will say
Can you guys clear something up for me? I've got a confession to make. I don't know what the term truther means.
You don't know what the term truther means?
I've seen it used, size truther. Like, so is it just a conspiracy theory? Like, this is probably
sort of like a...
So it's like, is it somebody who's, like, got a tinfoil hat? Like, is that what that is?
Yes.
Is that right?
Like, yeah. They believe the truth is being obscured from us. So they have, like, you know, they're in search of it.
See, I learned something.
No, you're right. I was trying to think of, like, a mainstream conspiracy theory that isn't, like, wildly offensive to bring up here.
Other than Kyler Murray's height. Okay. So, yes, here we go, Albert. Just to get the, you know, a person who doubts the generally accepted account of an event, believing that an official conspiracy exists to conceal the explanation.
Okay, so it's like a
JFK truth. There are a lot of JFK truthers, not 9/11 truth. That was the example I was trying to avoid.
Climate change truthers.
That's a perfect one.
Yeah. So
okay, I'm glad we got that off the table, because I've heard you guys have helped me out here because this was the right forum for me to finally admit and come clean that I don't know what that means.
No, it's, you know,
I've heard them referred to as size truthers,
right,
on Kyler.
This is a learning experience. I will say that when Dan Patrick quoted the scout, did anyone else notice at the end of the clip he just slipped in that it was a former scout that told him about the height? So it was picked up everywhere that Dan Patrick says a scout tells him that he thinks that the height is not actually the height, and then at the end he's like, oh, it's a former scout, so it wasn't
like
someone
wasn't
who was there.
Yeah,
right. I thought that was a little bit, that sort of got overlooked.
I think that the fun thing about where we are in digesting and analyzing the draft process is how much fair and open-minded pushback there has been towards, you know, some of the norms. And, you know, an example like that where people are like, well, this isn't even a current scout. Or if you look back at what happened with Charlie Casserly, where, you know, this guy, right or wrong, destroyed this kid, but ethically he's also preparing kids for combine interviews. And like, there has been stuff like this layered through the draft process for decades, and kids have been, you know, unfairly affected by this and hurt by this. And I feel like over the last few years, and especially with Kyler this year, there's at least a pushback to where it's sort of mainstream, where people are acknowledging the fact that some of these kids are just totally put through the ringer for no good reason.
The one thing I would say is, you know, with the Kyler criticism, and obviously his agent pushed back very strongly, which publicly he definitely should, I think privately you should take that feedback and say, if there
Absolutely.
Are teams saying this about you, and maybe they figure it doesn't matter because Arizona will take him number one overall. But if you're sitting in a room with an owner and a general manager and a head coach, and people are coming out of that without the right, you know, without the best vibe from you, not that that you were the worst interview they ever did, but maybe they have some questions about you as a franchise guy, then I think that could be used as a learning experience. But I agree. I mean, of course, this time of year is one of the worst times of year where all kinds of things about these guys are picked apart and discussed. I mean, you wouldn't want me to pick apart your style on this podcast, would you? I mean, Orr came in wearing a brewery sweatshirt and a Grandview University ball cap.
That's right.
Dress to impress.
Always.
All right. News item number 4. Ryan Fitzpatrick. He's back again. Signed a 2-year, $11 million deal with the Dolphins over the weekend. Miami will be the quarterback's 8th team.
That's remarkable. One
so
quarter of
awesome.
The league.
That is, yeah, I didn't think about that. It's 25% of the league.
What was McCown? What was he? How many teams was he at? Is it that many?
He's got to be close, too,
they're,
right?
They're probably pretty close, but this might be more than McCown.
I would sign both of them.
Both?
You know, yeah.
And just make your quarterback room Ryan Fitzpatrick and Josh McCown?
Totally. How much fun would that be? Just a good vibe, a lot of positivity.
Who would start?
I would still go with Fitzmagic because McCown is older and he's the mentor, so he'd be mentoring like a 37-year-old Ryan Fitzpatrick.
That's hilarious. I mean, I was wondering what the Dolphins were doing at quarterback. Like, we didn't know. Like, they didn't have, like, who was going to start. Right?
I think this is brilliant, though. I mean, I don't know, you know, if anybody else is going to agree with me or not. But,
oh, I agree.
Yeah.
I agree.
I think this is a smart tank. I mean, you're going to have to do it anyway. And this team has been lost in the weeds at the quarterback position since Dan Marino left.
Yep.
I mean, let's be real. And there's 3 or 4 coming down the pike in the next 2 years. If you legitimately have that buy-in from ownership, which is something that you really need to secure before you kind of walk this tightrope. But at the same time, just do it. You know what I mean? Get a left tackle in the draft this year and make sure he's ready for next year, or a right tackle for the time that you draft the quarterback. Do all the things, put all the little things in place that you can put in before that guy, the future, gets here. And in the meantime,
well, I mean,
Fitz magic all over the place.
I mean, I compare it too to like what Cleveland did, like where, and look, they got killed and rightfully so. I mean, Carson Wentz has a chance to be a generational quarterback and all of that. Like, so
pour
passing,
one out for Sashi.
Passing, but I mean, like, some of the logic behind passing on quarterbacks that year wasn't bad. I mean, Baker Mayfield walked into a much better situation in 2018
100%
than Carson Wentz would have walked into in 2016. And so to say, like, Carson Wentz would have had the same success in Cleveland as a rookie when he was playing behind, like, Lane Johnson and Jason Peters and Jason Kelsey in Philly as a rookie, like, it's hard to say that, isn't it? Like, it's hard to say that he would have had the same, and he had Joe Thomas in Cleveland, but it's hard to say he would have had the same success. And so I don't mind waiting to take a quarterback, which is what the Jets and Browns did last year, right? In 2017, they waited, or 2 years ago, they waited in 2017 and the Browns waited 2 years. I'm waiting 16 and 17, and they wind up with Mayfield and Sam Darnold. I also like some of the creative things the Dolphins have done. Like, they're literally buying draft picks now, like paying part of Ryan Tannehill's salary, paying part of Robert Quinn's salary if he gets moved, and he could get moved by the time the pod gets up online on Wednesday. Like, I think you're sort of thinking outside the box and doing some different things that have a long game in mind.
This is boring. We all agree.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think it's a great direction, right? I mean, that's where I think Adam Gase and the Dolphins wanted to split, because Gase would have been going into his fourth season as the head coach and didn't want to restart. So it made sense to part ways. You start with a new head coach. Chris Greer steps into the, you know, control of all football operations, and they just do a restart for an organization that has been stuck in that, like, you know, they're always picking, like, you know, in the
middling.
Yeah, they're just mediocre record, middling draft picks. What a great word, Connor. Thank you for being our thesaurus always. So, yeah, I like it. I think they're gearing up for it. Like, everyone knows going in. And I don't sense, you know, obviously in Cleveland there was going to be tension and things like that. But I think everyone in Miami, at least for now, seems like they're really on the same page and genuinely like each other.
My one concern, so I guess this is the one, like, thing, I guess a truth or moment for me a little bit.
Ooh.
It's like, you think about the way that Cleveland installed, you know, the Sashi Brown regime to essentially do what the Dolphins are doing now, right?
Yeah.
Which is to liquidate all assets, you know, to do the unpopular things, to grind through two really horrible seasons. But, like, if you're Greer or you're, you know, or you're Brian Flores or you're anybody there, you have to make sure that you're coming out the other side and you get to reap the benefits of this, because
right.
We are such a minute to minute league. And, you know, what if at the end
and
of these
so much of it depends on, like, just being able to get along with other people in your building when things are tough, because
that's why I brought it, because that's why I think the difference is. And
yeah.
I don't think in Cleveland, even at the, like, okay, it's easy to say that at the start,
right.
But even at the start in Cleveland, I don't think everyone got around. Like, I think almost as soon as everyone was hired, there was tension, right?
Yeah.
So, but you're right. Ownership could get impatient. You never know.
And the flip side of it is ownership could get impatient too, because Miami's one of these places. Like Cleveland, you flip the lights on and everyone in the city cares about the Browns, right?
Right.
Like, you don't have to do anything for everybody to care about the Browns. And the Browns are bad and people there are passionate about them being bad, you know, like angry. And like, Miami's one of those places where if they're no good, like, it's going to be a little bit of a business problem, you know? And so that's going to test the patience of ownership too, to some degree, mm-hmm. over the next couple of years as they're going through this. It's like, we're really tearing this thing down to the studs. It's like, and it sounds great now sitting here in March, but what happens when there's 30,000 people in the stands in November and they're 2-9? You know, like, that's the thing that I think is going to test ownership a little bit.
I think that they know what they're getting into. Like, I think, you know, maybe Hugh Jackson felt like he didn't quite know exactly how extreme it was going to be. But I feel like everyone in Miami understands what's happening. They know what's happening. They are gearing up for it. And, you know, I think it's a smart direction. And I feel like people in that city are just kind of sick of, like, a mediocre team.
Right.
You know, like, and you said, you know, it's very different market. It's not a football town.
Right.
But they're sick of a mediocre team. So maybe the prospect of on the other side coming out is, like, something that's exciting and a contender.
Right.
And it's a really good year to skip a quarterback.
Yeah. Seriously.
Yeah. I mean, it's like if you look at it, and I think a lot of teams are going to do that too, is like looking at the 2 years of quarterbacks against each other, like, which is what I think that's where teams probably made the mistake in passing on Patrick Mahomes 2 years ago. And to be fair, he was like a different type of prospect, but there were, like, again, like the Jets, the Browns, like, where they looked at it and they studied both classes and they said 17 and 18, and it's like, would we rather have Mitch Trubisky, Deshaun Watson, or Patrick Mahomes, or would we wait for Josh Rosen, Sam Darnold, Josh Allen, and then Baker Mayfield came into the picture later? I think it's the same thing here, where it's like, are you going to look at, would you rather have Haskins, Murray, Daniel Jones,
Drew Lock,
or would you rather wait for Tua Tagovailoa, Justin Herbert,
Jake Fromm,
right? Like, so I think that question is going to be asked a lot over the course of the next month with a lot of these teams. Like, they're having to prepare right now. Like, what happens if Dwayne Haskins slips? Like, you know, like, if you're the Dolphins, like, what happens if Dwayne Haskins starts to slide a little bit? And we're going to get to that in the Connor Orr mock draft 1.0, right?
Ooh.
Yeah.
That's coming.
Ooh.
That's coming.
When will that be posted?
Hopefully never.
Well, but. I think we're going to touch on that at the end of our news topic. So let's jump into news topic number 5. Connor, Jenny, you guys want to take this?
Chiefs wide receiver Tyreek Hill is under investigation for battery. The victim, according to police, is his 4-year-old son. Yeah, it's just an awful situation.
Yeah.
I mean, just an awful situation.
Yeah. And I don't think, you know, it's interesting because it sort of tells you how talent affords second chances. And I looked this up the other day, how long it took them to cut Kareem Hunt after the video surfaced. And it's different, of course, because the video proved that Hunt had lied to them. And but, you know, like, he winds up off the team, I think it was like in under 6 hours, right? So that was like that. That was very, very quick. Look, Tyreek Hill deserves a chance to defend himself like any other person in this country deserves a chance to defend themselves when they're accused of something. But I do think it's fair to say that if this was not that sort of player, he'd be off the team right now. Like, if there was somebody who had that sort of history in college and then was charged with something like this, I do not think there'd be hesitation to get rid of him. And there's proof of this, too. Like, I think there was a corner with the Niners. I think it was Tremaine Brock. Is that what there was someone who was charged with, who was accused of domestic violence and was cut almost right away. And the Niners had a statement that came out like, we're zero tolerance. Like, now, guy never had a chance to defend himself in this case, but they said we're zero tolerance, we're not gonna stand for this sort of thing, and they got rid of him, and 3 or 4 months later he was cleared. And so I do think that even though, like, there is like due process to all of this, I think we can safely say that if that is not one of the top 5 players on their roster, I think there's a very good chance he's gone. And if it's someone below like 15, like the 50, someone like from 15 to 53 on the roster, he's absolutely gone. He's gone the minute the police report surfaces.
I think in this case, you know, I think others have said it the past few days, but this is a situation where you would consider a lifetime ban because he has, you know, he's a prior history of very extreme. Strangulation is one of the more extreme levels of domestic violence. And then this would be under that category. And child abuse, I mean, is also,
as bad as it gets.
So I think, you know, we talk a lot about how zero tolerance policies don't work and shouldn't be the norm. And I certainly agree with that. But coming in with the history that he had and going, he went through, you know, whatever. We don't know exactly the details of the treatment and the counseling, but they had said he had met all those requirements. So did the legal system, because this case was expunged from his record last August. And then to have this case, you also sort of wonder, right, like, if it's happening now, like, would there ever be a time when it, you know, unless he went through very, like, intensive therapy, which he clearly, you know, if this is true, he has not reached the point where it won't happen again and has everything on the line right now, right? So he's would have been about to sign a big contract extension
this year. Like $100 million contract,
right.
Probably.
So I think it's a lot of things. And I think this situation really does spark the conversation of what exactly, when we give people second chances, what system in place is around them? You know, you can't just say, oh, it's the locker room culture. No. What therapy are they getting? What resources are the teams offering? And I think this is a good opportunity to examine that.
Right. And I think look, if you want to go back to the 2016 draft, this is a guy who was like untouchable for a lot of teams based on what he did, right? Like based on what happened in Oklahoma, at Oklahoma State, there were plenty of teams that says like we cannot draft him, and most of it was, from what I understand, like my research was, like a GM saying, how can I take this to my owner, like how can I go to my owner with this and say like I want to take this guy. And so, you know, I think there's that part of it too, which is like for a lot of these teams, it's like, where's the line? Because now, like, the Chiefs are on the hook for this. This isn't like a random, this isn't Ray Rice. Like, Ray Rice was different. Like, Ray Rice, there was no sign of anything coming, and then it happened. You know, like, this is very different from that. This is like Andy Reid giving a guy a second chance, and now it's almost like they're giving him another second chance because they're hanging on to him while all of this goes on. It's just like this part of the reason why it's part of the reason why like some teams just won't touch situations like this. And the Chiefs, because there was a prior, like they're on the hook.
I don't think they're as guilty of this as maybe some other teams in recent years, but you cannot continue to accept the credit for being an open locker room and being the kind of place that fosters a positive environment if this continually happens. You know what I mean? Like, you can't be the team that's like, well, we can take chances on these people because, you know, we turn people into men and we help all this right. stuff out when, you know, twice in a 2-year span, obviously very different things, but still extremely serious, horrific things, you know, yeah. from players that were drafted in the same, you know, era, the same time frame. And so, you know, I think that, you know, if you know that you're not able to help or you're not able to create the right environment, then you have to stop taking
right. And it's fair. I think it's also fair to put Andy Reid in the hook for it too, right? Because he's done, like, this is part of who he is. Like, he's always given guys second chances. Like, and you can go back to Philadelphia and Michael Vick and Terrell Owens, and like, he's always been like a second chance guy. And so, like, the benefit of that is that you're like, we talked about this with the Steelers, like, the benefit of that is you're casting a wider net, right? Like, so you're going to be able, you may be more talented than another team because you're willing to do this, right?
But then put the extra resources in place right. if that's the plan. Right. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Rather, like, it's empty words otherwise.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Right. Okay. So there's no easy way to transition from one to the other, but I did want to get into Connor's mock. So
is Connor still reeling from my comment about his style? You have great style. Actually, we were at the Indianapolis Combine and someone came up to Connor and complimented, and the guy literally said to him, "You have great style."
Great style.
Connor was wearing a Georgia Tech.
First time I've ever heard that in my life.
And it was, I mean, so I took a photo to commemorate the moment.
What were you wearing?
Georgia Tech, like, dry fit or
yeah,
something?
Yeah, just like a quarter zip. Nice. You know?
Oh, quarter zip.
I'm a huge fan. I'm wearing one right now. I've become a huge fan of the quarter zips.
You know, I tried to make it so the expectation was if I dress like sort of an out of work youth basketball coach every day in my life, that when I do dress up, it pops. You know what I mean? It's right. like, oh my God, like, you know, if you put on a button down shirt to go out to dinner, this is a big deal.
So you're,
you know,
like, you're lowering expectations.
Absolutely.
Right?
And then so you can, so you step out and you're wearing khakis one day and it's like, bam. I mean, wow, where's this guy going?
You Connor know? Orr, style icon.
So what do we got in the mock?
Man, well,
is Kyler going one to Arizona?
Yes. Yeah. I think I was texting Jenny until like 1:30 in the morning last night, and I was just like, okay, you're the Lions at number 9. Who are you taking? And
so she put on her Bob Quinn hat and
we're going with Trace McSorley. No, I'm just kidding.
It was late. I just wanted to throw him a curveball.
No.
And see if it got in there.
Yeah, you know, just I figured I'd go a little different, you know.
I didn't really mean that. Why'd you put that in there?
Wouldn't it be amazing, though? You know what I mean? Like, there's got to be one time. It was so funny. The first mock draft that I ever did, I remember I was like, I'm going to be a little different. I think I was like 22 or something like that. And it was the year that the Dolphins picked Ryan Tannehill, yeah. right? And I had the Cardinals trading up ahead of the Dolphins to take Ryan Tannehill, and I don't know who their quarterback ended up being at the time.
Was that like during like the Ryan Lindley years?
Could have been probably. The Ryan Lindley years, yeah. Right. And so
they had that big tall guy from John Skelton,
yes,
from Fordham, yeah.
Could have been John Skelton.
Yeah.
Ooh.
But I remember being like, okay, I'm the only one that's doing this. Ryan Tannehill to the Cardinals, and like, this will be my calling card. And so I remember very specifically Peter, our former boss, the MMQB, the next morning after the draft, like, I think I introduced myself to him at that point. Like, I'd looked up to him for a long time. And then there was a note in the MMQB that said, anyone not putting Ryan Tannehill with the Dolphins, specifically to teams like the Cardinals, was trying too hard. But like, so like, but like, I don't think it was meant as like a slight to me, but it was like,
but
I
felt like one.
I felt like I was like, okay, then just stop trying to be an idiot and really start to try to make sense of this. So I think it was good. It was a good lesson.
So Trace McSorley probably not to the Lions.
I don't think Trace McSorley.
Can I see
going
if I can guess his list? Like, I'm not looking at anything. I haven't looked at the mock.
Yeah. Wait, hold on.
Let me see if I get the top five.
I think my actual pick for you there was Gary to the Lions at 8.
Okay, so we have. All right.
So my Lions pick is actually, I would say, one of my spicier picks in the mock. However, I feel like I defended it well.
I want to see if I can get the top. Wait, so the Lions are who?
Do you want to know who I picked for the Lions?
Sure.
DeAndre Baker,
I'm gonna do the five.
Cornerback
okay.
out of Georgia.
Okay.
Do you want to know why?
because he's scrappy and physical and Matt Patricia's type of player.
Out of the consensus top five cornerbacks, DeAndre Baker played the most even ratio of man to zone. So in a Matt Patricia defense, you want to be versatile.
Oh, I like it. And Kirby Smart's a Nick Saban guy. Matt Patricia's a Bill Belichick guy. All right, so I'm going to say Kyler 1.
Yes.
Okay, we already established that. Nick Bosa 2.
Yes.
Josh Allen 3 to the Jets.
No.
Oh, Quinnen Williams.
Bang.
Quinnen Williams
3 to the Jets. Okay, so it's Josh Williams 4 to...
Josh Allen 4 to Oakland.
Josh Allen 4 to Oakland.
Okay.
Number 5.
Here's when it gets wild.
Fifth is
Tampa Bay.
Tampa. That gets wild, huh?
This is where it gets a little crazy.
See, I think you're like trying to throw me off, and it's really just Rashawn Gary.
It's not Rashawn Gary.
Who is it?
Rashawn Gary's an or slider, a little bit of a slider.
Okay.
Devin White, LSU.
Wow. I like that.
Interior pressure.
That's a little linebacker.
Sort of like the Roquan Smith. Like you heard, like last year you saw him in the teens, then he rose up through the process. So I like that.
A little
All right.
Cayenne on your mock draft.
Little paprika.
I like it. All right. Appreciate you guys coming out. You can look for Connor's mock draft.
More importantly, let's read Jenny's Le'Veon Bell story, which is actually good, and it's going to be on the website. Please,
they'll both be on the website. Bye.
Don't read the mock. Just read the Le'Veon Bell story twice, please.
All right. Thanks, guys. Okay, we're going to jump into the six-pack now. You guys know how this works. Every week on Tuesday, I put the call out for questions on Twitter. If I pick yours, you get an answer on the podcast, and you get a like. That means I hit the little heart on Twitter. And we'll get started with question number one. This is from Let's Get It at Cam and Mike. What do the Giants do about a quarterback, edge, offensive line, or corner with the 6th and 17th picks? I think they'll consider the quarterbacks, but I don't think that they're locked into taking one here. I also think that we have to start to look at Eli Manning as a bridge quarterback. I know it sounds crazy to do that, but that's what this guy is right now. And he's going to make $17 million for next year. I can understand why having a known commodity in the building, a guy that you where you know how he's going to react, you know how he is, you know how he's going to be with a young quarterback. I understand why having him in the building and keeping him there is like okay. Like I I'm fine with that. I think too many people are hung up on him as a franchise quarterback when right now he really is their bridge quarterback. So I think they'll look at guys like Haskins, guys like Daniel Jones, guys like Drew Lock with the 6th pick, with the 17th pick. But I don't think they're locked into the idea of it, and I do think there's a potential that they punt and wait for next year's class with Tua and Fromm and Herbert. I do think that because of the strength of this draft, that at least one of those picks and potentially both of them will be on an edge rusher. And so that could be Montez Sweat. That could be Rashawn Gary. That could be a number of different guys. But I do think that they're, you know, if you look philosophically at who Dave Gettleman is and who the Giants have been over the years, they put so much value in those defensive line positions. We saw it in how he built the Panthers with guys like Star Lutulele and KK Short, and how those Giants teams he was a part of were built. The Super Bowl champion teams were part of, he was a part of, were built. So I think at least one of those two picks will be devoted on a defensive lineman, and potentially both of them. Question number two is from Will. It's at For the G-Men. Another Giants fan asking a Cardinals question. Do you think Arizona keeps Rosen as insurance considering his contract is cap friendly? No. I think if the Cardinals draft Kyler Murray, and that's the big if, but if they draft Kyler Murray, I think Josh Rosen will be traded, and I think they should be able to get a pretty decent return on him based on the fact that as of right now, the low end for him is that you get a quality backup for the next 3 years at $6 million. The high end of it, you could have a franchise quarterback for the next 10 to 15. And so if you're the Chargers, or you're the Patriots, or you're the Steelers, or you're the Saints, or you're the Packers, and you got a quarterback who's deep into his 30s, in some cases late in their 30s, and other, in one other case into their 40s, and you're not going to be bad enough to draft one high, this could be a creative way to solve your problem. And so I do think there should be a market for Josh Rosen. I do think there are going to be some teams that are going to step up and look at him. And I can tell you this, something I wrote on Monday afternoon. Teams have started to do background work on Josh Rosen, asking guys who've coached him, who've worked with him in the past, about who he is personally. So teams are doing that research on Josh Rosen right now. And I just think his value as an asset is too high. where if they draft Kyler Murray, they'd hang on to him. And I think that the smoking gun here, as far as their intentions when that come, as far as that's concerned, they went in and they brought in a veteran quarterback in Brett Hundley, who sort of matches up with what Kyler Murray is as a player. And so at the very least, I think bringing in Hundley tells you there's no plan to have both Murray and Rosen on the roster. If you really want to look deep into that, maybe you make the conclusion that Hundley kind of matches stylistically with Murray a little bit. Question number three from Dustin Fletcher. That's at DF Sports 1007. If you are a team looking for a huge impact on the defensive line, who would you pick that is not named Quinnen Williams or Nick Bosa? I'm going to go off the board here. Now, some people might expect Rashawn Gary, who's a physical freak. Some people might expect Montez Sweat, who's got like a little bit of stuff in his past, but is a high-end athlete who's very productive at Mississippi State. I'm going to go off the board, and I'm going to go with a guy who's hurt right now, who has a serious issue in his past that happened when he was in high school, very serious issue in his past. That's Jeffrey Simmons, the defensive tackle from Mississippi State. When I was making draft calls ahead of the combine, you know, what I've heard over the course of the last 3-4 months is that this draft class, if you want to just rank the prospects on who they are as players, it's Nick Bosa and Quinnen Williams and then everybody else, right? So the one pushback I got on that narrative as we got close to the combine was Jeffrey Simmons is in that group. Now, that's before he tore his ACL, and that's with what happened 3 years ago where, you know, he was caught on video hitting a woman, which is a very serious thing that teams are going to have to vet out. This is a guy who was mentioned as a player in that breath, like who they believe could be that sort of player. And so I'm going to go off the board and give you Jeffrey Simmons there. Question number four, this is from Dan S. That's at DJ S Vegas. Chiefs defense up or down? This is tough because you do lose Dee Ford. You do lose Justin Houston. And you brought in one of the safeties you wanted. In Tyrann Mathieu, you came close, but you didn't get Earl Thomas. So I'm going to say up because I really like Steve Spagnuolo as a defensive coordinator, and I like some of the guys they drafted last year, okay? Names you might not know. Dorian O'Daniel's one. Breland Speaks is another. Derek Nottie's another. I think they've done a decent job of putting some good young players on that defense. They've got some draft capital to move around this year. It's a good defensive draft, and so I think the Chiefs' defense is going to be a little bit better just because it was so bad last year. But certainly, you've got to make up for what was your strength, which was that pass rush with only Chris Jones coming back, and Chris Jones has to be taken care of contractually too, and Dee Ford and Justin Houston out the door. Question number five, this is from Tremaine Gendron. His question, what position are the Tampa Bay Buccaneers targeting in the draft? Do you see them going after Morris Claiborne in free agency to add a veteran that knows Todd Bowles' system to help them with their young cornerbacks? I do not think that you're going to see a corner in round one because there's not one worth the fifth overall pick, despite what Connor might say about DeAndre Baker. I do not think there's one worth that worth a pick that high. Pass rusher, I think, is a possibility just because where the strength of the draft is. And then Devin White, you know, that makes some sense to me too. I would say that there's probably, you know, there's a little bit more of a need probably on the back end, but based on the way the draft class sets up, the strength of the draft class, what we're seeing from that group in general, I would say that you're probably safer taking a defensive player up high. And question number six, and now I'm going to have to go to the grab bag, right? Because here's the issue. The issue is I was irresponsible about this, and I only picked five questions, and I think my producer Brandon over here is laughing at me, but I'm gonna just randomly pick one. I'm going to scroll down here. I'm going to give you the like. I'm going to answer your question, okay? Because I thought I picked, and I did pick six. Okay, this is from Normal Guy, at Guy 16. Normal, will the Niners trade for a WR1 that's a wide receiver one? The answer to that question is maybe, because I know I can tell you right now that they were the other team that was in, and I wrote this last week, in the Odell Beckham sweepstakes. They have been sort of monitoring the Odell Beckham situation for the better part of a year. I know that Kyle Shanahan would like to have the sort of weapon that he had in Atlanta with Julio Jones, in Houston with Andre Johnson. And so if one of these guys were to become available, if an AJ Green or even a Julio were to become available, I think they would be all over that possibility. I don't know who that number one receiver is going to be. I think it would probably take a contract situation. Julio, of course, has been promised a new contract. AJ Green's going into the final year of his contract. I think they'll be all ears for those sorts of situations. I can't promise you that one's going to arise, but what I would tell you is that if one does come up, I think they're going to be in it. Appreciate you guys coming out. As always, we want your feedback. Connor, Jenny, me, we all want to make this podcast the best we possibly can. We want to make it your podcast, and we can do that if we hear from you. So hit me on Twitter, at Albert Breer. Hit me on Facebook, at Albert R. Breer. Hit me on Instagram, at Albert _ Breer. With whatever comments you've got, good or bad, on how we're doing the podcast. And always remember to listen to this podcast and the other podcast we're running this time of year. That's the Monday Morning Podcast on the MMQB feed featuring Andy Benoit and Gary Gramling. We're all on one feed now, the MMQB NFL Podcast. You can get us on Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, Google Play, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your shows. Same time next week. We'll see you guys then.